Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, continuing the reading of my 2015 novel, Bust It Like a Mule, The Tale of Cotton Kingfisher. Chapter 9. There are some years during Cotton's wandering that are missing like pieces in a puzzle, and I guess that is for the best, for a man has a right to tell or not to tell where he has or has not been, though the puzzle, when it is all said and done, might seem incomplete. Some years, like the war years, are the toughest to figure, and I know this is what Cotton would want. So that is all right by me, though I did wish I know what accounted for those years, whether it be good or bad. I have heard some tall tales about Cotton living with Indians in New Mexico, and his dancing Dakota days and all, and about some stints in prison, but I cannot be sure, and I guess I won't be telling what I cannot be sure about. I do know of one stint in prison in Colorado when Cotton considered he had drifted too long like a piece of scrap on a river, and it took him too close to the accusing finger of Oklahoma, if you will look at a map and see what I mean. And he wished he had never had drifted that close to his old home. And that time he drifted too far, he was put in prison, some men say for thievery, but I know that is a goddamn lie, 'cause he was no thief, as I was telling you before. But I think it was more on account of his violent temperament, just like in this boxing match we are watching, because we all know Cotton is a damn ornery mule, strong cuss who does not mind a good fight, whether it be right or wrong. In that stay in prison in Colorado, he managed to kick up such a fight like a cock-fighting rooster in the prison yard that he started a god-dang riot, by God, with all the men fighting him, then turning on one another till the guards had to shoot their rifles into the air, but no one had stopped, because if they stopped, they were getting sacked, because they sure as hell knew Cotton was not quitting, being as how they had been in prison with him a few weeks and his reputation had been proved. The cockfight turned riot was so bad that they sent Cotton out of that prison that very same day because he was such a pain in the neck and ass, and the warden drove him to the state line and uncuffed him and said, "And don't come back." And Cotton said, "I guess I don't reckon I will." And the warden turned the car around and left him standing there on the side of the highway on the Utah state line, by God, and it was the best deal either man has ever made. You might be wondering what that story has to do with the price of eggs in China, and just hold your horses, I'm about to tell you, for crying out loud. I was going to tell you that Cotton made another best deal he has ever made the day he agreed to fight that Terry kid and to beat him, and for that pretty red-dressed jail raven hair beer bottle beauty mark to put all her money on him, and she did. It was a hell of a deal, and you will soon find out why, and why I told you that the other story to tell you he made another best deal of his life. The men rushed him and jumped him, and a bunch of them got clipped good, and someone had to break a chair over his head, not once, not twice, but three times to knock him out cold. And as he lay there on the ground out cold where they had drug him off his victim, Terry, that jail girl came over and stood looking down upon him laying there like a fallen angel that had fallen too far and hit too hard, and she tried to read his scars, but it was hard because they were hard to bear. And women do not have a strong stomach for this sort of storytelling, though it stirs something within them like the deep, dark strings of man twanging within them. I reckon that this is on account of women having a piece of man in them coming from the rib of Adam when God made them, that when they see a man such as Cotton, and all the scars that the man's strings twang within them like the guitar strings inside the curvy body of a guitar echoing. I ain't saying I know this, just that I suppose it, and I guess no one can really dicker about it since I just supposed it. So this girl is there looking down on this drifter laying spread eagle on his back with blood spilling on the floor and bruises starting to form new stories on his flesh, and the man that had taken the bets came over to the girl and said all angry-like to her, "Here." Not like Cotton says "here" to say stop or what the hell, but to say "here," that he had a fat wad of cash to give her, being that she had put all her money on Cotton just as he had said to do, and she had won all the dough and the kitty, by God. It was a lot of money, for all the men had bet against Cotton, and if they had have won the bet, they wouldn't have won but jail's cash split amongst them, and she was the only one that bet against Terry. Poor Terry was beat to hell and bleeding bad, so they drug him out to the doctor. But no one drug Cotton out. They just let him lie there on his back bleeding with a greasy $50 bill on his naked chest like a medal for winning the fight. Cotton was dreaming of dancing girls and he was getting kissed. But then something went wrong and he was in the water and he felt like he was drowning and he could hear dings and zingers and he was wading ashore into a blowing up hell. Then he sat up and realized they had thrown a bucket of water in his face and he was coughing and gasping, then finally laughing and woo-wee, he called out, though he sees and hears wrens and robins and barn swallows about his head circling round and round, tweeting like sons of bitches, and all the men stayed away from him, for they had never seen such a thing as they had just seen, especially for the man that had shown them the things they had never seen to sit up and laugh and say woo-wee. Cotton looked about and saw the place was a mess of blood, and for a second he panicked like he had panicked before in his life, but he does not want to talk about why he panicked before in his life, and I do not blame him. It's his story to tell or not to tell, but he panicked now like he had before, because he thought he had killed Terry, who was but a kid, and he was supposed to work with him tomorrow. He looked and saw the jail girl was looking at him, and she was the only one standing with him, and she saw him panic for a second, when he thought he had killed Terry, and she shared this moment with him like no other woman had, for he had never panicked in front of a woman before, and it was like a guitar string was plucked between them and the curvy body of the girl when she saw him panic. Then the panic passed, and the girl says, "You weren't kidding about putting my money on you," and Cotton says, "Do I look like a kidder?" And she said, "No, sir, you do not," but not sir like before when she had called him sir to mock him for being a bum, but now because he deserved to be called sir after that show, by God. Then this big sun-faded red-dressed girl does something real sweet-like. She sits down on her heels like a baseball catcher crouching at home plate next to this brawler and covers her knees with that red-faded dress so as not to be improper, and she hands him a wad of cash, and he says, "What's that for?" And she says, "You won it." And Cotton felt all choked up a little. He wasn't even sure why, just that she had given him the money, he guessed. And no one had ever done something so nice for him, though they had, but when it's a pretty girl, it's a whole hell of a lot different. It just is. And we all know it. And I mean no disrespect to Indian father, or the husband and wife in the fruit stand, nor any of the others who have done Cotton a kindness, and neither does he mean them disrespect. "I can't take your money," he says, trying to stand. "Then why did you tell me to bet on you?" "I meant for you to keep it. I can get a damn job." "Well, I got a damn job, so take it." "I don't want it. I won my prize money," he says, and he holds up his 50, and she says, "Stop being ornery," and throws the money at him, and it hits his naked, bloody chest, falls to the floor. Then she turns and goes downstairs, and he is left alone outside the ring with a cash lion and bloody water at his feet. So Cotton picked up the cash and he went to the washroom downstairs and washed up and put his shirt back on and greased his hair. And not to be outdone, he goes and sits at the bar and orders beer and a steak, though JL says, "You should go on now." But he refuses to go on now, so she has the cook make him the fattest steak they have on hand, and she serves him two beers at once and just keeps bringing them. The rest of the room is silent, for most of the men have gone home. And Cotton eats in silence, just watching JL's switch-hipping, but not saying anything, just eating. When he finishes his steak and taters, the best meal he has eaten since the fruit stand, he pays JL with the 50, then pockets the change she give him. And when she comes out to see if he needs another beer, she finds him gone, and the wad of cash she threw at him sitting there on the counter as her tip. And she smiles and feels sort of all choked up a little. She wasn't even sure why, just that he had give her the money back that he had told her to put on him, she guessed. And no one had ever done something so nice for her, though they probably had, but it's a whole hell of a lot different when it is an ornery mean cuss who is oxbow strong and mule kick tough that didn't care if he won or lost as long as he was fighting, and you and I both know it. So she smiles and tries to hide it, and she feels lonely all of a sudden like Montana is a very big place to be so all alone in. Chapter 10. Cotton left the Dog Leg pool hall and found a liquor store and bought a bottle of whiskey and still had some cash to spare from his prize-winning 50. He felt stiff and sore and a bit hazy, but good all the same, for he had taught the earth what's what, and he had a beer bottle, beauty mark, big sky, pretty girl to dream about, and he had whiskey to help him dream and to dull the pain of the fight. He went to the churchyard and sat on the bench, and he drank the whiskey straight from the bottle, and he heard the train coming into Stumptown whistling Dixie, and he closed his eyes and leaned back and thought, wasn't life wonderful, until he saw flashing lights on the back of his eyelids like he had seen before and he didn't care for, so he opened his eyes and there was a small town police car and a small town police officer, a cop, Cotton would call him, with his hand on his gun staring him down. "Can I help you, Ossifer?" Cotton says with a smile, and the officer says, "You need to come with me." And Cotton says, "Why, this is a free country, ain't it?" "But you aren't free to beat a man half to death," the officer replies, and Cotton thinks he has killed a man for a second, not hearing the half part of the whole death thing, the officer just said, "So get in the car." "I won that match fair and square, just ask the kid," Cotton says, and the cop says, "I can't ask the kid, you messed him up too bad." "He ain't dead, is he?" "No, but he looks like he could be. He'll be all right in the morning. We had them damn sissy gloves on. Get in the car. Make me." And the officer twitches like sweat is stinging in his right eye with his hand on his gun. Then Cotton laughs and says, "Just kidding, damn you, then I will." Not even caring if he is getting arrested or not, because he just whooped the earth's ass. The officer opened the back door of the paddy wagon and Cotton clambered in. Then they drove a block to the police station and Cotton laughed because it took longer to drive than it would have just to walk to the damn place. The officer took Cotton inside and opened up a cell and Cotton figured he at least would get a free bed for the night, so he obliged until the officer said, "Hand me over your rucksack," and Cotton said, "Go to hell," and he meant it. And the officer could tell that he meant it, not like when he joked, "Make me," so the officer let off a bit. "Do you have a gun in there?" the cop asked. "No, I've a knife, but you can't have it." The cop didn't seem like he cared much for the whole thing, especially after hearing of the beating Terry had took. So he let Cotton inside the cell with his bag, even the whiskey in it, and he locked the cell and Cotton drank whiskey until he passed out. The prison bed was the most comfortable bed he had slept on in a while. Hell, it even had a pillow, and he used his Indian blanket and was snug as a bug in a rug, feeling warm from his head down to his toes and not just from the whiskey. The next morning, Cotton woke all groggy-like, and he stumbled to the front of the cell and pressed his face and arms through the bars and shouted, "Here! Here!" But nobody came. He cursed and was angry, for he needed to go get a goddamn job at the Forest Service, and he was hungover and bucksore and hungry. But what could he do? So he rolled a cigarette and started smoking it, till about a few minutes later, he heard the station door open, and he looked up, and at the front of the cell, who should be by God standing there but that fine jail girl, and he thought he was dreaming, but he knew he wasn't. "Is this a dream?" he says, even though he knew it wasn't, and JL says, "Do all your dreams end up in prison?" And he liked her and thought she was clever, so he smiled and said, "Nah, just the good ones." JL was wearing a bright yellow summer dress with her black hair pulled back but for the bangs across her brow, and Cotton saw that she had freckles across her nose, and it made him happy to see like the stars up in the big sky or the wild Indian paintbrush flowers on the plains the other side of the Rockies. She pushed something through a slot in the bars, and he said, "What's that?" And she said, "Breakfast." So he went and took the plate she pushed in at him, covered in shiny foil, and on it was a great mound of potato hash and scrambled eggs and bacon, and he nearly wept, for it smelled so good, and she brought it to him, and another one of this girl's kindnesses he wasn't sure he could bear to suffer, like when she had tried to give him back all the cash she had won on him fair and square. Then she handed him some silverware through the bars, even though he had his own in his bag, but she didn't know that because she'd never seen the inside of his rucksack like we have, thank God. For she is a woman, not a slob, nor a hobo, nor any kind of girl Cotton is used to in the first place, and Cotton began to eat, with JL looking on, though he knew his manners were terrible, and he tried for them not to be, but he was just a boy when he left home, and his mama was never good with manners anyhow before he left, so his manners were lacking, and he knew it. "I'd ask you to pull up a chair, but I've got none," he joked. And that jail girl smiled kind of sad-like, and he wondered why she would smile so sad when she was such a pretty girl and such a pretty dress and such a pretty place, being at the land where the world began. "Did I kill the kid?" he asked as he bent his elbow and his mouth flew open. "No," jail replied. "He was in the hospital last night, but they took him home this morning. He's got a lot of stitches and a broken nose and a few broken ribs." Cotton squirmed a bit on the bunk where he was sitting when she said this, because he knew he had no need to break any ribs in a boxing ring that even had a bell. But he also knew that when he played for keeps, and he could not care if someone cried over losing their favorite cat's eye. He wondered what the girl had come for, but he didn't want to ask as to be too forward, and he liked her company just the way it was, so he said, "Thanks for the grub. I figured it was the least I could do for winning a bunch of money off of you. I've never gambled on the fighting before. I don't know what possessed me. I do, it was me." And that girl blushed, though Cotton meant no harm over what he'd said, and she knew it. "Did you bring this from the restaurant?" he asked as he handed her back the empty plate through the bars. "No, I made it myself at home," she says. And this made Cotton feel warm all over like whiskey that she had cooked him a meal and had thought of him in her kitchen, as he knew a kitchen was a woman's sacred place, and to think of a man in it was a good thing for the man she thought of in it. He had been with women the last few years that did not see the kitchen as a sexy, sacred place, and it had always made him a bit put off by them. Jail stood there at the bars, and he rolled and lit a cigarette and offered her one, and she took it. Even though he had rolled it with his own hands and they were maybe a bit grubby, she didn't seem to mind, so he gave it to her and lit it through the bars, and they stood smoking on either side of the cell. "Thanks for the meal, sister," he says. "You're welcome. Where are you from?" she asked, blowing out smoke, and damn, she looked fine and sparkly through that smoke. "Everywhere but here," Cotton replies. "Why are you here?" "I heard that this is the land where the world began, and I figured I'd better come back and see it, and see if I could find me some Indians like back in the old days." Just then the door jangled on open, and an older policeman came in that Cotton suspected was the younger officer who had arrested him's boss. And this policeman sees Jail standing at the cell with the bloody pugilist, and he says, "What in the hell is going on here?" And Cotton says, "That's what I'd like to know, Captain," and blow smoke through the jail bars. Chapter 11. Jail left in a hurry, like she wasn't supposed to be there, and the police captain let Cotton out of his cage by saying, "They took Terry home from the hospital this morning, and I can't keep you here as he isn't dead, and that damn boxing ring is perfectly legal, although if there was betting, it isn't." But Cotton didn't let on that there had been betting. "If I had my way, I'd take that damn thing down, because it is just a place for trouble." And Cotton can see this cop is all bowed up, so he tries to unwind him by saying, "Ain't that the gospel truth?" And the captain gives him a disapproving look, like Cotton does not really think it is the gospel truth. He's just saying that it is to please the captain, and that dog don't hunt with the captain, by God, so just cut it out. "So maybe this ain't the best time to ask where a fella can get a job," Cotton goes on before the captain can get too angry at him for trying to fleece him over about the boxing ring. "Son, what in the hell are you thinking? You wander up here and beat the hell out of the town's main boy and then ask for a job? What is wrong with you? You're old enough to know better." And Cotton suddenly gets hot under the collar for another man that is a bit older than him to talk down to him like that, like he is just a snot-nosed kid, and he has to talk to the angel on his right shoulder to ignore the devil on his left, or otherwise he is going to get into an illegal boxing match right here in the station, with the captain being the next Terry kid he beats senseless, by God. "I am just a working man that needs a job, is all," Cotton says, and the captain goes to his desk and sits down all distracted-like and says, "Well, that may very well be, but why don't you first try not to beat the hell out of the townspeople?" And as much as it galls Cotton, as they say in the older testament of the Bible, because gall is real bitter, I think, he says, "Yes, sir," and this seems to work a bit on the captain. Are you getting out of town?
No.
The captain rubs his head all flustered like and says, Do you have a place to stay?
No.
Well, you need to get a place to stay. You can't just be hanging out in town causing trouble. Besides, you never know when a few good old boys might want to jump you after what happened to Terry. But Cotton does not think that anyone will jump him because all the good old boys had seen what he had done to Terry with their own two eyes. Now you go on down to the Hungry Horse Motel and tell them that Captain Carter said to, But when the captain looked up, that crazy, coot, violent drifter was gone out the door with not even a word nor a sound, and Captain Carter was powerful angry, for he knew he was bound to have more trouble with that SOB, and he wondered why in hell he hadn't told him to skedaddle like a by-God stray. But that's just the way it was with Cotton, and when the captain ran outside, it was like Cotton had disappeared, for he was neither in the street nor the park nor anywhere. Cotton hid in the back of a pickup truck outside the police station until Captain Carter went back inside the station. Then he lit out to find the ranger station that he suspected was up the road a piece, so he started walking. Now, as Cotton was walking, he got to wondering what a pretty sundress-wearing, freckle-faced, crow-haired girl would be doing bringing him a home-cooked breakfast in jail. And it made him feel goddamn good. So goddamn good, in fact, that he felt like he had a bird in a cage in his chest. And the only way to let that little birdie out was to sing. So he did sing, like he'd heard his daddy sing. Back in the day, you see, Cotton did this every so often. He would sing like his old man. Who knows what makes women do the things they do, like put all their money on a man who is a son of a bitch. And then win all the money they bet on him, and then try and give it back to him, then bring him breakfast in prison when he refuses to take the money back. Cotton did not know, and neither do I, but I guess this is what makes women so wondrous to men, at least in part, is their peculiarities that man cannot understand. All he knew is that he didn't think sad thoughts, just good thoughts, like about kicking the earth's ass all the way back to kingdom come. And this made him laugh a little to himself, but only just a little, because kicking the earth's ass and laughing about it is a good way to make the earth angry enough to come raring back at you, and it is just rude besides that. After a piece of walking up the road, Cotton came upon a big outfit with lots of buildings and tourist attractions and campers roaming about, but he didn't see no real Indians nor teepees, though this was the land where the world began to the Injuns, according to Indian Father. Cotton went to the main building, and he walks right on in and right on up to a lady at a desk who looks up at him and seems a little frightened on account of his appearance. And she was, for at first she thought he was a wayward hiker who had been mauled by a by-God bear. "Came to find me some work," Cotton said, and the lady made him sit and wait. And rings for a man to come see Cotton about a job, and also just to throw him out, because he looks like he was just mauled by a bear, and there is no reason for a man to look like he is mauled by a bear if he ain't been, and that is why she would like to throw him out. Well, a man with a navy mustache came out and stopped when he sees Cotton and says, "Can I help you?" And Cotton stands up and goes to the man and shakes his hand and says, "So when do I start?" And the man looks at the woman at the desk as if to be cross with her for offering Cotton a job, and she just shakes her head and presses her lips together to tell the man that she did indeed by God not offer this here mauled bear man a job. "What do you do?" the man asked Cotton, and Cotton replied, "Little bit of everything." And the man seems unimpressed by this and starts to tell Cotton why he cannot hire a man who does a little bit of everything. And Cotton sees him start to go into his wind-up to cut poor old mall-bear man down. So Cotton, being the shrewd businessman that he is, cuts the man off and says, "I guess effin' you don't need a veteran fire chief who is handy with a Pulaski, I'll be on my way." And as sure as the devil, this man stops him from going, for he knows that Cotton knows what a Pulaski is, which is a firefighting tool with a mattock and axe head put together, named after the firefighter Big Ed Pulaski that made it. So the man says, "Where were you fire chief?" And Cotton replies, "Down in Oregon on the coast. Have you heard of the Tillamook burn?" And the man had, for there had been a few fires on the coast there in Oregon that had burned the hell out of the mountains. And they were big, mean fires, and sometimes on Oregon fire crews the Okies would bust it like a mule. And Cotton had been one such Okie, though he did not say this to the man, but he could see the man had great respect for him when he told him about working the Tillamook burn. Then the man said, "How would I know that is true about you working on the Tillamook burn?" And as Cotton tells stories by his flesh, and not on paper like some by God application or references or whatnot, he pulls his shirt down a bit, and on the right side of his neck down his back, he has an ugly scar from a fire burn, which was plain to see, and he says, "This is how." And the man had great respect for him, just like the men in the dog leg when he beat the devil out of that son of a bitch, Terry. And the man is also intimidated by such a man as Cotton, who would get such a burn and keep on ticking. And the woman at the desk covers her mouth to see such a scar. But what the woman at the desk does not understand, but I do, is that men don't always talk with words or with paper. Sometimes they talk to one another with scars. And this is what Cotton and the Forest Service man were doing. Well, I will be tarred and feathered, and so was the woman at the desk, that after this exchange, Cotton was hired right on the spot. But that's just the way it rolls for Cotton, and you and I know it, though the woman at the desk don't. Well, I guess she does now, don't she? So Cotton was hired on at the Forest Service before word of the hurt he lay on Terry the Kid had chance to get up to the Forest Service headquarters where Cotton stood. And I will be damned, by God, they even gave him several uniforms, all green and brand new like the ones Terry wore, and a place to stay since his work was seasonal. And listen to this. The best part was that they gave him a new truck for his own, though he didn't even have a goddamn driving license. That's all for tonight. You've been hearing my novel, Busted Like a Mule. I'm Caleb Manon, and have a heap of help from Mike Ailman and Vern Windham, who recorded and edited it. It is a production of Spokane Public Radio for The Bookshelf. Busted Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course. Oh, and the author's front porch. For original music and more about the book, visit CalebManon.com. Catch you next time.